object lessons as to why the Constitution is still relevant and necessary. Next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to today's edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principal Policy. And along with me today is our co-host, the Vice Chairman of the Institute, my fellow analyst and very good friend, Chuck Michaels.
And it's great to be back with you, Barry. We've had an interesting day today, sort of surveying the Michaels Ranch, having a look at all the work we're doing around here. And it won't be long now before I'm in my new studio.
Well, you know what? That's wonderful, Chuck, because it seems to me like you have got over election trauma syndrome, or ETS.
I never had election trauma syndrome. The part that what I had a trauma over was getting away from the campaigning.
You didn't feel like going out and protesting in the streets and burning cars and otherwise publicly humiliating yourself over the results of this last election?
Not since about 1976, and the impulse didn't hit me very hard then either.
Okay, very good, very good. Well, you know, we've been seeing in the media lately, Chuck, and it's all over the place, how many people... Funny how at least in one demographic subsegment of these people, we found out didn't even bother to go vote in the presidential election.
Isn't that an interesting take on that?
That we have a certain subsection of our culture right now who just feels like, well, they didn't get what they wanted, so they can go throw a temper tantrum and go and do protests and sit-ins and burn cars and block highways. And Chuck, oftentimes with tragic results, as we learned the other day in a protest. I forgot to see where it was, but they blocked an ambulance. And so a father of a four-year-old child who had been critically injured in an accident ended up dying in the ambulance because the ambulance was being blocked from moving forward by these anti-Trump protesters.
Yeah.
Now, I don't think that there's a jail cell with a basement deep enough to bury these people in, who frankly are nothing but cultural and social anarchists who are not going to be satisfied until they're the ones who are wearing the jackboots and are putting the guns to the heads of everybody that they don't agree with. This is absolutely nuts. I mean, this is the type of behavior that they were claiming that if we elected Donald Trump as president, would happen to them. Funny how that shoe fit on the other foot.
Well, it's called judging others by yourself.
Yeah, well, you know, and sometimes maybe there's a lot more truth to that than people would like to let on. Anyhow, so we've still got all these protests, and we're now starting to find out they look like they've become choreographed, paid, and funded protests, usually funded by folks that you and I have talked about numerous times on this program, like George Soros, the globalist who has got his fingers in just about everything and was the founder of MoveOn.org, if everybody remembers that old chestnut from the Bush administration.
Right.
MoveOn.org was setting the groundwork for Barack Obama to become the president. And now that the Hillary Clinton campaign couldn't find their way out of a wet paper bag in order to win the election, oh, but she won the popular vote.
She won the
popular
vote.
Now, didn't she?
Yeah.
Okay, well, you know what? Okay, first of all, let's certify that popular vote first. I want to figure out how many people voted who otherwise were maybe illegally here in the country, voted who were otherwise dead already.
Yes.
And who voted who were otherwise don't exist at all except in somebody's false documentation. I think if we had state's Secretary of State actually doing the hard work of going about digging into these voter rolls and being diligent about it instead of using election night as a platform for their own future political aspirations, like we have here in Ohio, then you would probably see much more clearly that the popular vote was much, much more narrow than what is being reported. But of course, we've got people out there who really, they want to set the narrative. They want to set the narrative that it's all about the individual determination of who becomes president. And if we've just got a pure democratic mass of 50% plus one aggregate across the country, then that's the only fair thing to do, is to make that person the president of the United States. But that's not the way our founders intended. And we're going to talk about that in a little bit. They've got a couple other little items in the mailbag here we got to play with. But we're going to talk a little bit more about why we don't do it the way the progressive left wants it now done. Now, these were the same people who, the eve of the election, Chuck, were calling for a certain Republican nominee who was yet to be voted in as president to accept the results of the election. You remember in the last debate, and even after that, being hounded by the media, will you accept the results of the election? Because the left and the leftist media had already determined that Hillary Clinton was going to be the next president 3 weeks prior to the actual votes being cast.
Oh, well, the crown had essentially been cast. The jewels had been put in that crown, and it, all that remained to be done was for the coronation to take place. And on election night, oops, a jester came and stole the thorny crown as the...
yes, as American Pie, Don McLean song. And no, we're not going to play that, folks. But Chuck, you know, you and I were talking offline before we started recording this today, and you brought up a critical point of what were Bill and Hillary Clinton wearing on election night?
Purple. It wasn't on election night. It was on the day
on
after.
On the day, on the morning after. That's
when
the, right.
When Hillary finally did her concession speech.
Right.
They were wearing purple, and it was symbolic. Now, it depends on your point of view on
yes.
what that symbolized.
True.
People who are trying to make a case that Hillary was basically still campaigning are saying that the purple represented a mixture of the colors of blue and red.
In other words, we need to bring the country together around the consensus candidate, i.e. Hillary Clinton, because she won the popular vote.
If you take another view of the Clintons, which I think is closer
to the actual truth,
yes,
that's right.
Purple is a color that's associated with royalty.
Absolutely. Yeah, we call it royal purple for a reason.
And essentially, I think Hillary Clinton and Bill, because he was wearing a purple tie to her purple collar blouse ensemble, I'm not sure exactly what it was. I remember seeing a picture of it. They were both saying that the queen has been usurped.
Yes. Yes. Along the road to the coronation, somebody put a detour. And that detour may be a permanent detour, because I believe that coronation road is now permanently closed to someone whose last name is Clinton.
Hillary is done because at the next election cycle, at the beginning, she'll be 74.
Absolutely. Now, that doesn't mean she probably can't run again, but the likelihood of her being able to create a coalition around the broken remains of her current coalition is highly unlikely. Now, you and I talked about this both off air and on air here in a previous program about we're saying the end of the Clinton dynasty completely. And I said, wait just a minute, Chuck, because we forgot about one other Clinton, and that is daughter Chelsea, who is coming into her liberal own. And sure enough, after we finished that program, within what, 2 days? Within a day, headline news in the New York Post, Chelsea Clinton being groomed to take Nita Lowey's congressional seat in upstate New York.
Poor Nita Lowey. Nita Lowey, I don't know if Nita Lowey is contemplating retiring or not.
Well, they consider she's 80-some years old, they're just assuming that she will not want to serve, first, A, under a Trump administration, and B, possibly with someone other than Nancy Pelosi being the minority leader.
Well, 20 years ago, when Hillary was elected senator from New York, the presumptive nominee for that Senate seat was Nita Lowey.
Right, and so she's been given the short shrift for 20 years. What's to change now?
Yeah, exactly. Well, I didn't realize Nita Lowey was that old. I knew she was older. I didn't know she was in her 80s.
I will double check while we're going here. The magic of having an internet right in front of us while we record. I will take a look and see how old she is.
Yeah. Now, could Chelsea step into that spot? Probably.
I'd say she's 79 years old. She will be 80 next July.
Okay. Well, the chances of her running too many more times. I mean, we all know about Robert Byrd.
And John Dingell.
And John Dingell and these people. But look.
Alcee Hastings. Yeah. Wait a minute. I'm starting to see a theme here.
Yes.
The Democrats don't want to let go of power to the point where you have to bury them in order to get them out of the seats.
And even then, what they would like them to do is move to Chicago so they can vote.
Continually. That's right.
Yeah, I realize that's supposedly an unfair crack, but it's not really, because Chicago's
already announced that they're going to continue to be a sanctuary city for people who are breaking the law. What's to stop them from being a sanctuary for people who want to vote after they're dead?
It's nothing new. Remember, Lyndon Johnson's nickname was Landslide Lyndon, because in his first Senate race, it turns out that some ballots were quote-unquote found.
Yeah, of course.
And one Texas town, everybody voted in alphabetical order, which was really kind of interesting if you think about it. All these ballots came in from this one town, and everybody voted in alphabetical order.
Yeah, socio-psychological experiment they were running at the university,
yeah.
I'm sure.
It's sort of like, I don't know if you've heard about Issa.
Daryl Issa.
Yes, okay. In California, his seat was in some danger, and it seemed like he squeaked out a win on election night. Well, all of a sudden, more ballots have been uncovered.
Imagine that.
And let's go back not too long ago. In recent memory, we've got Al Franken, who was elected by, they found a car trunk full of ballots.
Right. All of whom were cast in crayon for Al Franken.
But it wasn't enough, so they found another car trunk full of ballots. And that put him over the top. So, you know, I always laugh about these guys saying they have the moral high ground. Yeah, well, you stole your election, so moral high ground somewhat undermined. Your moral foundation is a little rickety.
Yeah, well, there is that, isn't
but,
there?
But that being said, Chelsea does not have a sterling reputation. As we brought up before,
sure,
she's not considered to be particularly adept at the things she's attempted to do to keep her name in front of the public. She was, for a time, hired by a network, and I can't remember which one. I think it was NBC, but I'm not sure, to do sort of lifestyle reports.
Okay.
And they were so few and so badly done that someone said at one point that she made about $28,000 a minute.
Wow.
For her report.
Nice work.
For her reports. Yeah, essentially. And she eventually resigned because even she realized that she really wasn't cut out for that kind of thing.
Well, and sometimes that's good when you come to that understanding and decide, this just isn't the right fit.
All right. And what does Chelsea do now? Well, she works for the Clinton Foundation.
Wow. Now, there's an interesting fit going into the family business.
Yes.
I like that.
But as we discussed earlier, and again, folks, we're sorry we couldn't record this so you could listen to our lunch conversation. Most of it you would have found probably sort of inside baseball, and you just said, huh?
And the rest of it would have been hearing us chew our food.
Chew our food, okay. Yeah. But that being said, what's about to happen to the Clinton Foundation? Well, let's see. Since it was essentially money that flowed in to maintain influence, and
they have no more influence.
And since influence has just been cut to a mere fraction of its original power.
You're being so nice.
I am being nice.
You're being very nice.
There's no reason to send money to the Clinton Foundation anymore, and the Clinton Global Initiative is done.
It'll still be around for a while, just like any other liberal edifice. They always keep it propped up somehow in order that they might be able to hornswoggle, finagle, or use it for graft once again.
Yes. It'll stick around till somebody figures out, no, this is a dead horse, and they'll dismantle it and disperse the assets. And as I said today, they would be wise to take a storefront in the Bronx and vacate whatever high-dollar offices they now occupy in Manhattan.
Sure.
Because the Bronx storefront is about what they'll be able to afford once it becomes clear that Hillary's not going anyplace else.
Oh, sure, absolutely not. But, okay, now, Chuck, now, this is the thing, and I kind of had to laugh about this. Because, you know, immediately after the election, you know, and Hillary did not go and give her concession speech that night, and there are all kinds of speculations out there, reasons why, from the point that she was, like, you know, totally exhausted to the point that she was totally enraged and had thrown a hissy fit behind the scenes, to the point that she may have had far too many double martinis and was totally inebriated, to the point of she may have just not been able to internalize and process the fact that she wasn't going to be president. But, you know, when she comes out the next day, the first thing that happened is some of her closest advisors, John Podestas of the world, et cetera. Well, Chuck, who did they blame? Who did they blame for Hillary Clinton not winning the presidency?
Well, FBI Director James Comey.
Comey, because Comey had relaunched an investigation into these emails because they had found hundreds of thousands of these national security emails on the personal laptop of one former Congressman Anthony Weiner, who happened to be the husband, for the moment.
Yeah, temporarily.
Temporarily. of one Huma Abedin, who happened to be Hillary Clinton's right-hand
aide-de-camp. Almost alter ego.
Almost alter ego, aide-de-camp. Complete breakdown of national security protocols. And something that we hope that the Trump administration will not brush off as being a campaign cycle phenomenon and will actually treat it with the seriousness that it deserves when he comes into office on January the 20th. But since that little meme didn't seem to stick with anybody, because it's hard to say you're blaming somebody who's just doing their job because you were doing something potentially illegal and they pointed it out, it's hard to get a lot of sympathy out of people
right.
for your plight by crying wolf. So what's the next place you can go to blame somebody other than yourself
right.
for the fall of your election? Well, Hillary went to blaming Podesta because of his email situation. And remember, the DNC got hacked and they got a hold of his emails too. And a lot of that email traffic really incensed even some of Hillary's own supporters, because it showed just how duplicitous they were to, Bernie Sanders and his people, or to some of their base.
Exactly,
What they really actually thought of their supporters. It wasn't just the Trump folks who were the basket of deplorables. There were some choice monikers that were used for some of their own base. And so Hillary started blaming John Podesta. Well, Podesta's going to get thrown under the bus one way or the other, somehow, some way, about some of this. So honestly, most of her supporters didn't buy it. That one, they floated up the mainstream media flagpole and nobody saluted. So, okay, we can't do Podesta now. Okay, so who else have we got to blame? Well, our friends over at the American Mirror have written this up. This came out. We're recording this on Wednesday, the 16th of November. And this came out yesterday on the 15th. And I have to say, Chuck, that it's rare, but there are times in my life when I see a quote or a phrase that is just so poignant, that is just so memorable, that is just so sticky in its message, that I have to grin. I'm smiling inside myself of reading this because I love the phrasing that they're using for this. So here's the deal now. Because they couldn't get it to stick to Comey, they couldn't really get it to stick to Podesta, and they certainly don't want it sticking to Hillary. Who's the next group to be blamed for why Hillary Clinton is not sitting there as the newly crowned queen of the world? Or President of the United States. Well, a headline by Kyle Olson says, Clinton camp blames white female, quote, internalized misogyny, unquote, for loss. I love that phrase, Chuck, internalized misogyny among white females. And it's hilarious. I mean, Olson does a great job of just pounding this one into the dirt. I love it. But the campaign communication director for the Clinton campaign, a lady by the name of Jess McIntosh, who happens to be a white female, Chuck.
Yes.
Because they've got a picture of her on a video feed. Basically claimed it was women with internalized misogyny who couldn't bring themselves to vote to elect the first woman president. So in other words, because you couldn't just act like a lemming and vote for the person whose gender was the same as yours. Now, what happened? I thought they didn't like gender terms. They didn't like gender identity in the liberals'
world. Gender neutrality only works
if you're not running for president.
If it works with you.
Oh, yes.
When it works against you, then suddenly we have the gender divide. Okay? And here it is. Gender neutrality isn't working in this case, and therefore we have a gender divide.
Yes.
And it's women who hated themselves who voted for Trump.
Yeah, because misogyny is the psychological term for someone who hates women. Okay, but Jess McIntosh said right here, when asked why Hillary didn't do better with women than Barack Obama did in 2012, this was her quote, "Internalized misogyny is a real thing. And this is a thing we have to be talking about as we go through and see." So did she answer his question? No, it was a bunch of gobbledygook, right. And she's throwing out something out there, some boutique fad malady, psychological issue, in order to basically put off the whole point of, we misread the electorate, we were arrogant, we only went to our liberal elites, and we only kissed up to them, and we basically treated everybody else like garbage, and then we expected them to just basically bow down and make us president, or make Hillary president. Doesn't work that way, folks. People see through that. In the age of immediate media, you can't get away with that kind of stuff anymore.
It's interesting you bring that up. I'm going to see if I can find something. But Barack Obama yesterday made the statement that instant access to information is actually inhibiting globalization.
Well, sure. If we can't keep you in the dark about what we're really doing, we can't do it, is basically what he's saying.
Yeah, it's exactly.
Okay, now, this is great, because McIntosh decides to double down on this bad bet, Chuck, because she comes through here and she goes, as we go through these numbers, as we figure out exactly what happened with turnout, it seems to be white, college-educated women.
Yep.
We have work to do talking to those women about what happened this year. Well, if you start by basically claiming that they're internalizing misogyny as their reasons for why they did, Hillary Clinton couldn't gain her support, I'm not sure you're talking with these women or talking to them and down to them.
Well, at them.
And at them, that's right. And why we would vote against our self-interest. Okay, first of all, Ms. McIntosh, maybe it's because white college-educated women have enough brain power to realize it's not in their self-interest to vote for a woman who pardons a rapist and attacks the rape victim as an attorney, who looks the other way for political expediency while her husband is slutting around with as many nubile college girls as he can get himself his hands on, and basically is allowing her entire coterie around her to be what looks like a frat house. From Anthony Weiner to everybody else around it.
Well, what's interesting about that, I'm glad you brought that part up, because one of the things that hurt Hillary so badly this time was letting Bill in on the campaign.
Oh, yeah, it was damaging her campaign.
Although he was magic in the mid-90s for some unknown reason.
The thrill is gone, babe.
Let's just say he was poison.
Yes.
In 2016.
Absolutely. He was extremely problematic for her. And I think that's probably the reason why that now, one of the reasons why that after the dust is now settling, because we're now going on another week after the election and things are starting to settle in, Gallup just ran a poll that basically shows that at 51% of the American public, that their poll numbers, 51% are more confident in the president-elect since the election than they were before the election. So in other words, all of the boogeymen that the Clinton campaign were putting out there as to what the state of the country was going to be, it was supposed to look like a gulag, if you remember correctly,
right,
with a Trump victory, isn't and doesn't look like it's ever going to materialize in any significant way, shape, or form. And many people who were otherwise either fired up against Trump or were nonplussed toward Hillary or starting to realize, oh, okay, you know what? The sun did come up on the 9th. The world didn't split down the middle, and Trump is going about the business of what every other president-elect before him has been doing, which is taking his time before January 20th trying to figure out who he's going to put in place in his cabinet and in various federal offices and what he's going to do to present a budget to Congress. Because those are the three major issues that a president-elect has to face day after they win the election is putting your people together, figuring out who's going to be in the cabinet, and figuring out how you're going to put together a budget to hand over to Congress for them
to
chew on.
Because the president has to submit a budget by
March 20th, I think.
Something
at the latest.
Like that.
Yeah.
And, of course, it doesn't take effect until October 1st.
Right. Well, yes. No. Because September 30th is the last day of each fiscal year. October 1 starts a new fiscal year. So.
And that's what I can remember. I used to laugh during the 80s. When in the middle of 1981, you know, Ronald Reagan took office in January 20th, 1981. And about the middle of that time, some of his advisors were on the Phil Donahue show, which always a mistake. But Phil Donahue is railing about how Reagan's economic policies are failing. Not this is like maybe May or June of 1980, and they're both these guys are saying, "Look, our first budget doesn't take effect until October 1st. You're not going to see any of our policies take effect until October 1st, but your policies aren't working."
Right.
Again, Phil, for the second and third time, they haven't taken effect yet.
Right.
We're still operating on the previous president's economic policies.
Absolutely, because all they did was pass temporary spending orders. They didn't ever pass a budget.
Right.
Okay, here's the deal. I went back. Let me backtrack. I said March the 20th, but that was the old date we used to swear in a president back in the 1800s. No, by the federal budget law, 31 U.S.C. Section 1105A, a president must submit a budget document between the first Monday in January, which is after he's already in as,
right.
as an incumbent president, and the first Monday in February. So in other words, when he's sworn in on January 20th, he's got 12 days.
Yeah, 12 days.
12 to 13 days maximum to get that budget to Congress legally.
Which means they have to hit the ground running.
Which means that they've been meeting with the Office of Budget and Management in D.C. since November the 9th.
They've had
to. You have to. Which is the reason why his picks for Treasury Secretary and for Budget Director and everybody else are probably the most crucial picks he's got to make right now, although everybody's looking at his pick for Attorney General and Secretary of State.
Yeah, right.
And it's like, yeah, those things are important too, but
right.
none of them have the absolutely dead hard deadline that submitting a budget to Congress has.
And I'll be quite honest, foreign policy and Secretary of State type issues and Attorney General type issues are not going to be the focus. It's going to be economics. I will almost guarantee you with a Donald Trump presidency, it's going to be an economic focus. Because let's face it, I keep hearing about how we've been in recovery since 2008.
Really?
Well, if we're in recovery since 2008, it's sort of like recovering from multiple gunshot wounds. Well, he's recovering nicely, but he's still in a coma.
Yeah, exactly. Wow, that's incredible. But, you know, but we still have a couple other things we got to work on, Chuck. And this is even before the president-elect takes office. Because, as we know, Barack Obama is going to be there until January the 20th when the
right.
oath of office is administered to Donald Trump. There's a lot he can do damage-wise between now and January the 20th. And I think that they're on a course for trying to do so. He's taking his final world tour jaunt where he's going to other countries trying to either pad his legacy or protect post-elective interests. But then we've got another. You brought me this article from the American thinker, Ed Straker, here a couple days ago, wrote an article that should send chills down most people's spines. Obama still might be able to put Merrick Garland on the Supreme Court during this lame duck period. And Chuck, this is, I guess, the I see what Straker's saying.
Yes.
And I get the whole point, and this is going to be up to now newly reelected Speaker Paul Ryan and Majority Leader Mitch McConnell to prevent happening. In other words, they have got to figure out their calendars and make sure they don't do something stupid like recess Congress for more than 10 days
right.
between now and January the 20th, because that's the only way Obama can get this done is it's called a recess appointment. Now, we've heard about recess appointments before. There have been numerous recess appointments.
Sure, there have. And this president is not remiss about using them.
Well, yeah, well, he put Rich Cordray in as his economic, you know,
guru,
consumer
affairs.
Advisor or something,
yeah,
like
consumer
that.
Affairs.
That. Yeah, consumer affairs guy with a recess appointment.
Yeah.
So if under the law, if Congress is in recess for at least 10 days, excepting Sundays.
Yes.
Because that's still in the Constitution, excepting Sundays. Then the president can do a recess appointment, and he can even do a recess appointment to the United States Supreme Court. Now, if you see McConnell and Ryan breaking Congress early and they have no plans to come back for more than a 12-day period, they are signaling to you they want Obama to put Merrick Garland on the court because he would have to be there, not till January the 20th, but he could sit there, and this is the one I have a little trouble with, he could sit there for 2 years.
Oh, until the end of the next congressional session.
To the end of the next congressional term.
Yeah.
So it could be December of 2018 before Trump could put a nominee on the Supreme Court. Now, if McConnell and Ryan aren't working with the president-elect to keep this from happening, I can tell you of two politicians whose careers they've just shortened to the fact that they won't be around politically in December of 2018.
I was going to say, at that point, it becomes clear, and it should become clear. A lot of people say, well, it was a very close election. No, I think there was a mandate. Yeah, it wasn't a landslide, but what did it do? It certainly wasn't an electoral landslide.
Now, wait a minute. He didn't win the popular vote, Chuck. Now, no, come on.
Yeah. And how did he do that? Well, there's a lot of people in California, lot of people, and that's where that popular vote overage came from.
And there's a lot of people in New York City. There's a lot of people in Southern California. There's a lot of people in Chicago, Illinois.
Let's come back to the Electoral College because we can discuss that, exactly why that's an issue. That being said, there is something of a mandate here. And what that means is, and what the mandate is Republicans telling Republican leadership, you have done us over too many times. This is why you got a guy you definitely did not want and don't want to have to deal with. Now, what would happen to a McConnell or a Ryan? Well, there would be demands to remove them from their leadership. McConnell as the majority leader of the Senate and Ryan as Speaker of the House. There would be demands. And in fact, I still don't know for sure if Ryan's going to make it. He's singing the right tune at this right now, but he frankly has no choice but to sing the right tune right now. So what's going to happen? Well, I think what you're going to find is you're going to have a bunch of these sessions where somebody shows up and they gavel back in and gavel back out.
Right, yeah, because you can do that. Those are called skeleton sessions. They are actual live sessions of the legislative body that count.
Yeah.
So it's good.
That's once you've established a quorum, and then you adjourn from day to day rather than adjourn the session. You can hold skeleton sessions until right up until the end of the term.
Right. Now, you know, it's interesting because, again, if Obama wants to try to play this game, and again, it's a constitutional provision because he can make appointments during the recesses that last until the end of the next session. That's what the Constitution in Article 2 gives you the power to do specifically. There is something that Donald Trump, as the incoming president, can do to Barack Obama's legacy and burn it to the ground almost, because there was a little-known law that was put in place in 1996. And in 1996, when a certain man by the name of Newt Gingrich was Speaker of the United States House of Representatives, this law was put in place. It's called the Congressional Review Act. Now, this law basically says that the president can review and with the passage of Congress, they can review and override regulations enacted by federal agencies. And there's like 60 legislative days to review and override regulations, but those 60 days are 60 session days. So when Congress broke in May, so anything that Barack Obama had issued and his federal regulators had issued since May of this last year up to when they hit the 60-day mark, Trump can, with a stroke of a pen, eliminate. And there's a lovely little kicker in the Congressional Review Act. And honestly, I guess this is one thing that I forgot about that I actually have to thank Newt Gingrich for, because this was masterful. If the law is used to strike down a rule, the federal agency that issued it is barred from enacting similar regulations again anytime in the future. In other words, it is it to the ground rule.
It's a dead letter, yeah.
If we pull that power away from you, you never have that power again.
Well, there's another way that doesn't require all this dancing. And it is that
put a zero in their budget line.
That's one of the ways. The other way is, yeah, Barack Obama had a pen and a phone, but so will Donald Trump. All he has to do is say, "I hereby rescind by executive order, executive orders number blah 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 blah."
Yep. So basically, yeah, he can do that, but with this rule, and Chuck, it only takes a simple majority, and it's veto or it's filibuster proof. In the Senate, it is not subject to filibuster, and you only need
51
votes, which you would have.
Which
you would have. He can undo over 150 federal regulations that have taken place in the Obama administration since last April, and anything new that comes up between now and January 20th. and he would have a compliant Congress to do it with.
Well, why do you think there are reports coming out that the EPA and the Department of the Interior are essentially having meltdowns because right. they know that a whole bunch of the stuff, the environmental regs and that kind of thing, that have are really just stifling all kinds of commerce and recovery, are sitting on the bubble because Donald Trump's come out and said, we're going to get rid of this. And Donald Trump is basically talking about rescinding all the war on coal
regulations. Absolutely. Which means that they might make him permanent potentate of West Virginia if he does that.
That's right, because let's face it, there is technology now. In fact, I have a friend who works in the energy industry. He is a, you know, he's not an engineer or anything, but he is a procedure writer for procedures to implement regulatory rules and regulations right. and that kind of thing. And he said
the implementation processes. Yeah.
He worked in Alabama, I think, on a zero emissions coal plant, and he goes, this is really fantastic technology. There are zero particulates that come out of the smokestacks.
Beautiful.
And there are zero CO2. It's all recaptured. He goes, the only thing that comes out of the smokestack is steam. That's it.
Yeah, and folks, yeah, technology has gone tremendously beyond, you know, but what we have is we have a hidebound bureaucracy that basically lives in a previous era, who basically thinks that the only thing that they're there for is to stop any kind of progress or any kind of commercial activity. I'm hoping that they use it. Now, again, this is something that isn't brand new, because the Republican Congress under Paul Ryan had tried to use this law to block federal regulations.
Uh-huh.
But the problem was, when it went to Obama's desk, he vetoed it. Of course. Now you got a Republican president with a Republican Congress who want to get rid of a leftist Democrat's onerous regulations on environment, health care. The list goes on, and the beat goes on, my friend.
Yep.
It could be interesting. Now, probably they won't go as nearly as far as many would like them to do with something like this. But the point is, you've got a Congress who is already shown that they're more than willing to use this law, and a president now who might just have a few things to take care of
right.
in relation to his friends and his enemies. And I'll just be blunt about it. Political payback can be murderous if you're on the wrong side.
Yeah.
And there are an awful lot of people, think Planned Parenthood, who are definitely on the wrong side. And Trump has, whether he's pro-life or not, he signaled that he's not really all that keen on, with Cecile Richards and Planned Parenthood spending tens of millions of dollars for Hillary Clinton to get her elected, I don't think he's going to be keen on allowing them to keep their budget line in his budget.
No. Why would he?
And all he has to do with a stroke of a pen is basically block any abortion provider or promoter from qualifying to receive Medicaid reimbursements, and then he takes care of the funnel down at the state level, too.
Well,
we could, honestly, ladies and gentlemen, and pray about this, and hey, contact Ken Blackwell, who was just named Trump's domestic transition team lead, and most likely will be his domestic policy advisor, and who is a fellow with the Family Research Council, to get Trump doing his first day in office to fill out that paperwork to
impound funds,
to block or prohibit a provider or promoter of abortion from being able to qualify to receive Medicaid reimbursements through the federal government or through the states. It'd be over with. Planned Parenthood would be out of business.
Yeah, essentially.
And so would many of the abortion providers who are not Planned Parenthood, because that's how they're making their money, is on reimbursements from state
Medicare,
and federal,
Medicaid.
Medicare and Medicaid. Folks, we could basically, without having to go to the Supreme Court for anything, all but eradicate abortion in this country. Stroke of the pen, law of the land.
Kind
of
cool,
huh?
Strobe Talbot.
Yeah, exactly. So here we go, guys. You know, again, Chuck and I will be the first to say we weren't big fans of Donald Trump.
No.
We still really aren't.
Nope.
But if he's willing to do things in a way that makes sense, are conservative, and that actually apply the axe to the roots of the tree instead of the branches, I will be the first person in the corner sharpening the axe for him.
Yeah. I was going to say, you and I have not been supporters of Donald Trump. No. Neither have we been overly negative because we see the positives that are coming out of this.
I can see some positive because, remember, personnel is policy. And so far, I'm not all that upset with his personnel choices.
No, in fact, I'm very happy that some got the axe already.
Like Chris Christie, who basically has basically been shown the door. I mean, it isn't so much that he just got demoted. I mean, he got demoted, and then there were rationales given for his demotion. Chris Christie is all but done in the Trump team.
There is a footprint on his posterior.
Yes, that's true. So, you know, we've got some things that we can be cautiously optimistic about, okay? I for one, believe—I don't necessarily believe that the list of jurists that Trump put out early on in the campaign are the actual people that they will be putting forward when it's time for him to nominate someone for the U.S. Supreme Court. However, with the exception of maybe two of them— Bill Pryor being one for sure that is an absolute non-starter for me ever.
Right.
The vast majority of those other jurists, and I've talked to some national attorney friends of mine who have to deal in venues where these judges reside, are saying most of their judicial temperament's fairly solid, fairly originalist intent, fairly not nearly at the Scalia level.
Right.
And that's the reason why I'm contacting Blackwell and whoever else I need to contact within the transition team, and I'm putting in a suggestion for them to seriously look at Sixth Circuit U.S. Court of Appeals Justice Jeff Sutton. Sutton was the majority opinion who turned down the Obergefell decision. That was overturned by the U.S. Supremes illegitimately and unconstitutionally, but Sutton's been the key writer on a number of freedom-enhancing, constitutionally sound, originalist decisions coming up out of the 6th United States Circuit, which Ohio sits in. He would be a fantastic replacement for Scalia. Oh, and by the way, he was Scalia's law clerk.
There you go.
His mentor was Antonin Scalia.
Yeah.
So if you want a judge in the mold of Antonin Scalia to fill that seat on the Supreme Court, Jeff Sutton's your guy. Now, I've not talked to Sutton, but I am talking to people who can make the decision to reach out to him, because that's my wish list, Chuck. I want to see somebody like a Jeff Sutton become the next United States Supreme Court Justice, because he's a young man. I think he's in his early 50s, which means he could be on the court for 40 years.
It could happen.
It could happen, you know. And if we can get another originalist who is on point with almost every decision he's ever come out with, on point constitutionally, and better yet, biblically faithful, without, you know, writing scripture into law, but biblically faithful, I think we could go a long way toward changing the entire environment around our legal process. But we got to have more people like him.
Yes.
And hopefully, this coming year will be the year that Anthony Kennedy decides to step down and that Ruth Bader Ginsburg decides to leave. And if we can get not just one, but three solid originalist appointments out of a Donald Trump administration, I will be extremely pleased. Now, if Mitch McConnell, as the Senate Majority Leader, decides that he's going to allow the Democrats to basically create a sideshow around the nomination process,
which
he's allowed to happen in the past. You know, there won't be an awful lot of love lost, and probably if McConnell runs for re-election in Kentucky, I might just temporarily move to Kentucky to help run whoever wants to run against him.
Yeah.
Because that would be absolutely just treasonous in my estimation.
Remember that Matt Bevin, who's
the
current governor of Kentucky, gave Mitch a pretty tough run for his money when he challenged him in the primary. And people that always say, well, you challenged an incumbent, and therefore you've destroyed your career. Matt Bevin doesn't think he destroyed his career.
Not so much.
And Matt Bevin is making some progress down in Kentucky.
Yeah, and he's actually going to be making more progress because Rand Paul just won in a landslide for his seat again to the U.S. Senate.
Right.
The Kentucky House of Delegates in the Commonwealth of Kentucky is now in Republican control for the first time since 1928. The Democrats have controlled the Kentucky House of Representatives since 1928 until this election. So you have a Republican/Tea Party governor who actually is the real deal. He isn't the Scott Brown type of
Tea
Party.
Right.
Who is the governor of Kentucky, who now doesn't have to fight to get a budget through. Not nearly as hard. Now, I'm not saying all the Republicans who won in Kentucky are all Tea Party conservative constitutionalists, because let's not kid ourselves, that's not truly the case. But the key is that I think that you're going to the state of Kentucky will be heard from today, in other words, as they say. And I think that we're going to like what we see coming out of there, and maybe part of what that will be is the early retirement of Mitch McConnell from the United States Senate.
It could happen.
And my prayers go up for that, too. I'm just, hey, folks, I am laying it out today. I am going to be transparent as I possibly can be. I want to see these obstructionists gone. I want to see us get back to constitutional adherence. I want to see us get back to a shared traditional biblical morality in this country. I want to stop seeing things like this article that Chuck and I just ran across today from our friends at Campus Reform titled, well, I can't even completely read you the title of this article, but I'm going to just say it's UMass, which is the University of Massachusetts, students hold protest for gender-neutral bathrooms, okay? And they're staging a week-long boycott or protest by occupying restrooms in an administration building to demand more gender-neutral facilities. Now, they use a very epithetic colloquial term for what they're doing, and which we're not going to say or reference on air. It's disgusting, but this is the kind of stuff, folks, that's happening because our culture has become schizophrenic morally. We don't understand anymore. Chuck, we're getting to a point of postmodernist deconstruction culturally and ethically that we're running away from terms like husband and wife and male and female because they may be harmful. and this is what this protest is all about. Now, this protest has been done. It started this Monday morning. So it's this week, and it may be over with by the time this airs on Saturday. But this is by a group called Gender Liberation UMass, or GLU. I would have put the M in there, too. Glum.
Glum, yeah.
Because they are pretty glum. Basically, they organized this event, put an online sign-up form for supporters to come in and set up times. It's like, you know, I'm going to pick Tuesday at 3 to 9 p.m. to go basically block and sit inside the restrooms in the administration building so nobody can use the bathroom. And they think that this is going to actually help them in negotiations with the administration, and they may be right because most liberal college administrators have this self-loathing. Maybe they are some of these internalized misogynists.
And misandrists.
And this misandrists, which is
men.
Hating men.
Yeah.
That we talked about with the Hillary Clinton camp. So this all fits together. And basically, what they're wanting them for this protest is to convince that administration to convert additional bathrooms on campus into gender-neutral facilities by changing the signage, which the groups will believe will promote, quote, trans inclusivity and safety on campus. But that isn't all. They've got two other demands, Chuck. And they also want the advancement of medically and socially competent in-house transgender health services at University Health Services Center. And because this is really all about the idea of being fair, Chuck.
Fair.
And we can't be fair without this last point. They want the hiring of a professor by the Women, Gender, and Sexuality Studies Department, their WGSS, who is an expert in the field of, get this, Chuck. Now, this is what some of us are hoping we're not paying our money for our kids to go to college to do, but we're probably subsidizing people who are. An expert in the field of critical transmisogyny from an intersectional perspective. Oh, my heavenly days.
Oh, yeah, well.
The wacko train has left the station and the brakes are off.
Well, this is such incredible bureaucratic
gobbledygook.
You know, What does that even mean? Trans misogyny.
Okay, well, if a misogynist is somebody who hates women, then is this only... Are they being discriminatory, Chuck?
Ooh, yes.
Because they're saying it's only about critical hatred of women who are trans, or is it of trans women? So in other words, am I supposed to hate the women who are dressing and acting like guys, or am I supposed to be hating the guys who are dressing in drag and acting like women?
I can almost explain this. And that is that why would any woman want to transmogrify into a man? Because after all, they're the enemy.
I you know what though? I have seen a number of individuals who are doing exactly that. As a matter of fact, one of the key directors over at NARAL, Ohio, there is real question as to what their biological original designation really is.
Well, Chaz Bono.
There's that too. Yes.
I mean, it's out there. But I think this is coming from the perspective, honestly, that the only way that anyone would really want to go is male to female. They wouldn't want to go... Now, okay, biologically speaking as a biochemist, you changing the plumbing does not... Now, I had people that absolutely said, no, you actually change into... No, you don't. The fact is that XY equals male, XX equals female... And we're going to ignore the tiny number of people who have true genetic anomalies,
right?
Because those individuals have issues that can't be dealt with.
0.0003% of the population.
It's a tiny number of people. Okay. The fact is, you can't change. You can change the plumbing, but changing the plumbing does not change the gender assignment.
Mm-hmm. You're right. It can't.
Bottom line.
But the point is, Chuck, these are sexual anarchists, okay?
Yes.
This is part of an ongoing broader scope effort to take away any kind of gender disparities, as they call them, gender-specific language from everywhere. That's the reason why we can't have his and hers, or men and women's, or boy and girl bathrooms. They have to be inclusive bathrooms or unisex bathrooms, because we might be being critical of someone because of their personal choices by utilizing traditional nomenclature for these type of things. And even these groups understand, maybe unconsciously, what they're doing, okay? Because here's how they talk about their own group. That they basically say, these demands are elementary, and it is disappointing that you masses failed to meet the needs of trans and gender non-conforming students to date. Non-conforming.
Right.
Because what they're saying is, we know there's a standard. We're trying to destroy it.
Yes.
That's what non-conformist is. I am an anarchist. I am throwing down order. I am creating chaos. That's what this is about.
Well, the only reason to create chaos is to attempt to rebuild a new order.
Where you're in control.
Yes.
Gee, that sounds exactly like the disappointment of the Hillary Clinton supporters who are crying for Electoral College to be abolished.
Amazing how that works, isn't
it? Amazing how that works.
And I'm glad you brought that up, because we also have an article that everyone really, honestly, go out to our website and read this article, because it's a very important article on the Electoral College. It's from, of all the strange places, it's from Yahoo Finance.
Through CNBC.
Through CNBC, another strange place for this to come from,
right.
Sort of. CNBC is an economic network, though, although it is, it's hooked up with NBC News, so again, it's strange. And it's entitled Op-Ed, quote-unquote, Forget It, Democrats, the Electoral College Will Never Be Repealed.
Yeah, written by Jake Novak. And I read this, Chuck, and I'm sitting there with my jaw hitting the ground, because I expected the... regular liberal boohoo, whining, cry my beer pablum about how the white misogynist men are just going to keep us from getting to our nirvana by keeping this old archaic relic, the Electoral College, in place. That's not what Jake Novak's saying.
No, basically what he's saying is it's not going away ever.
Because now, it's too important to protect smaller states and to protect people from basically what the founders feared the most, pure democracy.
And what we talked about earlier in the broadcast was the fact that this large overages are in very populous states. So in other words, what people want to see is pure democracy, wherein it's just simply a majority vote, and anybody who wasn't in the majority, well, it's too bad you lost. And if you want the perfect illustration of that, it's 12 wolves and a sheep voting on what's for supper.
Exactly.
Well, the sheep says, I'm going to eat some grass, and the 12 wolves say, we're going to eat you.
We're going to have lamb for dinner.
We're having lamb.
That's right.
So that's exactly what the Electoral College was designed to prevent. In other words, if the Electoral College worked the way it was supposed to work.
Correct.
The way it was supposed to work.
Which it doesn't even work correctly now.
But it works. But
it still maintains the vestiges and works well enough.
I give a lecture called The Electoral College, How It's Broken and Why... Original Intent, How It's Broken and Why It Still Works.
Which they can get on our site at principledpolicy.com.
I don't know if I've actually got that recorded.
Well, you did. I think we've got it somewhere. We'll look for it. Folks, we'll look
for
it. And we'll
I'm available to teach your Tea Party group or your church group or whoever you want. I'll come and do it. Contact us at www.principledpolicy.com. Now, that being said, the way it's supposed to work. Okay, you know how it works in that there are the same number of electors as there are for Congress and Senate for each state. So, in other words, Ohio gets,
16. We have 18 votes.
18
we have 16
total.
Congressmen and two senators.
And that's it. So Ohio gets 18 electoral votes. Now,
and California gets 56.
And California is 55.
Okay, yeah, that's right. 55. They lost one. That's right. They lost one.
Okay. Now, how's that? How are those supposed to be awarded? Well, by the original intent, they're awarded by congressional district.
Which is the way Maine and Nebraska do. And that's the reason why if you were looking at electoral maps on election night,
you saw stripes.
You had stripes through those two states. That's because they have to wait until the votes are counted in each of those districts to determine who won the majority of the votes within that congressional district, because they're the one who wins that electoral vote. And if you win the overall popular vote total in that state, you win
the
Senate votes.
That's it. That's exactly how it's supposed to work. Now, what has happened? Well, politicians saw the utility of this immediately, early on in the Republic, folks, in the 18-teens and 1820s. That tells you how far back this kind of corruption goes on. So what'd they do? They created winner-take-all laws.
Indeed.
Like Ohio has. So basically, anybody who wins the popular vote gets all the electoral votes.
Every electoral vote.
Right.
No matter whether you won. Like in Ohio, we've got 16 congressional districts. I'm guessing when the math is all done, Hillary Clinton will have won about 7 of those.
Yeah.
Donald Trump would have won 9.
Yeah.
But because Donald Trump did win the popular vote in Ohio, he gets all 16 of or all
right.
18 of the votes.
And what that's designed to do is keep the cities from overwhelming the countryside.
Right, and keep the large states from burying the small states.
Exactly, which is exactly what people are calling for that want the elimination of the Electoral College. They're calling for the ability for the urban areas to bury the rural areas and for the large states to bury the small states.
Right, so that basically we have the United States of California, New York, Florida, Texas, and Illinois.
Well, basically, yeah.
In Ohio,
right now, the way it's decided is Cleveland, Cincinnati, Columbus, Youngstown, Toledo,
Dayton and Akron.
That's who decides who gets our electoral votes. Do you like that system? I don't like that system.
I don't either. Sometimes it works out okay, but it would work out much better if the three congressional districts in Franklin County didn't all go to one candidate when you had 2/3 of the congressional districts that voted for the other person.
Exactly. So basically what we're saying is, in a very shorthand, because we're almost out of time here, it's designed to protect the interests of, honestly, the minority.
Yes, absolutely.
Which is exactly what, for instance, cloture in the Senate is designed to protect. It's designed to keep everybody from running roughshod majorities over minorities.
It protects the very same interests who pure democracy would destroy.
That's it. Now, unfortunately, we're out of time this week. I'd love to go more into detail on that. We kind of had plans to do that, but we can't do that.
So we will come back at that next week.
There you go. We'll come back at it next week. Well, you now know what we think. We want to know what you think. www.principledpolicy.com. That's principledpolicy.com. And we ask that you join us again next week for another Principles and Policies.